The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Hello. Congratulations, everyone, for making it this far through the conference and deciding to top it off on with a session on alienation. I guess I'm a little worried about you, though, as if all the other problems of capitalism weren't enough, inequality, war, planetary destruction, you also want to know how capitalism fundamentally distorts our humanity. And to be honest, I got a little depressed working on this talk, and it didn't help that even Marx noted that absent material changes, that sometimes actually being aware of alienation can make you feel it more acutely. But I think that's only part of the story, right? Because a Marxist understanding of alienation and where it comes from, I think, can actually be empowering and even disalienating in certain ways. In the first place, because you realize the things you're feeling, that you're not alone in feeling them, that they're not due to personal inadequacies, which is how we're often taught to think. And secondly, that these feelings aren't natural or inevitable, but actually rooted in specific material and social conditions that can be changed. So what do we mean by alienation? I looked up the dictionary definition for the word to alienate. Actually has two definitions, and the first is sort of what we probably think of as the common sense explanation, which is to cause someone to feel isolated or estranged. But the other definition is to transfer ownership of property rights to another person or group, which I think is interesting for reasons we'll get back to. And for the last couple months, I've had a Google News alert to see, you know, how alienation is being talked about and mentioned recently. And actually, the most common topic that came up was this concept of parental alienation, which I hadn't heard about. I don't know if anyone's heard of this. But it's basically the act of one parent, usually, you know, in a divorce situation, actually deliberately trying to make their kids counter to the other parent, to kind of sow bad feelings among their kids, which, you know, I think the fact that this is actually a legal term that's being used in custody disputes says something about the levels of alienation in our society, and especially within the family, which is supposed to be our place of refuge in the world. And if folks, if any folks here were at the last session on managing the poor and child welfare, I think, you know, for poor families especially, like the fact that you can be literally separated from your families is a constant reality. Another common context is in the wake of terrorist attacks, when news commentators often wonder how it is that Muslim youth who are raised in the supposedly liberal and tolerant West come to feel so alienated as to join the ranks of ISIS. Because, you know, there's nothing particularly alienating about being profiled, harassed, subject to racist travel bans, or watching Muslims being slaughtered abroad by your own government. And there's also some discussion of the alienation of white men, leading to an epidemic of domestic violence, mass shootings, and hate crimes, though, of course, this is less likely to be described as terrorism. In politics, the election of Donald Trump and also the popularity of Bernie Sanders have often been described as the, you know, explained as the alienation of the white working class. And the fact that so many people are so alienated from politics that they skip voting altogether, which seems to perplex the media. It's like an irrational response to a rational system rather than the other way around. And although the word isn't always used, perhaps the most telling indicator of the levels of alienation today are the skyrocketing rates of depression, anxiety, suicide, and substance abuse, illustrated most dramatically with the opioid crisis across the country. And I think on one level, this despair is quite easy to understand without a theory of alienation, because there's such clear economic forces that are driving it. And that might be why the last period when there was really a raging debate about alienation was actually in the 1950s and 60s. Because at the time it seemed to pose a conundrum. In the context of an unprecedented economic boom, at the heights of technological and civilizational progress, when more and more people than ever before were invited to participate in the so-called American dream, why were so many plagued still by feelings of emptiness and meaninglessness? And particularly as the radicalization of the 60s progressed, why were so many young people so discontented when they seemingly had so many advantages? So in other words, even capitalism in its peak condition does not lead to human fulfillment, but at the very least to a sense of a vague sense of discontent. But today, when the future promised to most of us is not an American dream, but a steadily unfolding nightmare, it's only gotten worse. We're facing an epidemic of loneliness and social isolation, which research has shown has a direct impact on mortality. And recent articles have pointed to the irony that so many people are so lonely in a world where technology, theoretically, allows us to be more connected than ever. In recent years, an entire happiness industry has developed around the problem that more material prosperity doesn't seem to make people happier. Thus, we have this weird kind of trend where, on the one hand, there's more people being forced into micro apartments because of skyrocketing rents, while other people are voluntarily moving into tiny houses in order to find some more meaning in life, I guess. And I think many explanations have been given, and I'm not going to go into depth in any of these, about why we have alienation in our world. For the existentialist philosophers, alienation is inherent to human existence and unavoidable. For some, it began with the rise of civilization and simply a price we must pay for it. And more recently, people have pointed to the withering of institutions which once promoted community, like churches, unions, or bowling leagues. And others, there's actually quite a bit of people who blame social media and technology itself. But for Marxists, alienation is not something we've downloaded on our smartphones or an inevitable feature of human nature. Rather, Marx argued it was rooted in how society is organized. And this probably won't come as a shocker to folks here, but he identified the problem as capitalism. And Marx wrote most extensively about alienation in the economic and philosophic manuscripts, which you pick up in the book room. And it was one of Marx's earliest works, consisting of unfinished notebooks that weren't published till decades after his death. And it's clear that Marx was just beginning to work out his theories of political economy, and much of it was actually intended as both a development and a critique of the philosopher Hegel. And of course, the ideas of Hegel and Marx's critique of them is a subject for another talk, which I don't volunteer to give. but suffice to say here that Hegel saw alienation as being caused by man's separation from God and human history as a process of overcoming this. So Marx drew on Hegel's dialectical method and his theory of change, but inverted it, seeing the roots of alienation as lying in the material world. And while many of his ideas were more developed in later works, the manuscripts offer some of Marx's most searing indictments of the psychological and spiritual toll of capitalism, and I think contains many insights that remain relevant to us today. So in the rest of this talk, we're going to loosely be structuring around the four main types of alienation that Marx identified in the manuscripts, which are alienation of the worker from their product, alienation of the worker from the process of production, alienation of humanity from what he called our species being, and alienation of individuals from other people. So I'm going to touch on the first two and then turn over to David to talk about the others. So in terms of the alienation of the worker from the product, I mean, this kind of goes to the heart of how capitalism works. Right. So in brief, under capitalism, the vast majority of us are compelled to go to work for someone else in order to survive. And in return, we're paid a wage to cover our own subsistence, but the product of our labor on the job, whether it's a physical object or a service, belongs to our employer. And it's such a normal thing that we don't really usually stop and think about how messed up that is, right? That basically, for the majority of us, most of our waking hours are spent performing labor and creating products that don't belong to us and don't gratify our immediate needs. Our work has no intrinsic meaning for us except as a means to an end. And the harder we work, the more it enriches someone else at our expense. As Marx described it, quote, "The worker is related to the product of labor as an alien object. The worker puts his life into the object, but now his life no longer belongs to him, but to the object. Hence, the greater this activity, the more the worker lacks objects. Whatever the product of his labor is, he is not. Therefore, the greater this product, the less he is himself. The alienation of the worker and his product means not only that his labor becomes an object, an external existence, but that it exists outside of him, independently, as something alien to him, and that it becomes a power on its own confronting him. It means that the life which he has conferred on the object confronts him as something hostile and alien. I have to say, I don't think this, you know, this is not to say that many of us don't take a lot of pride in the work that we do, both because of the often unappreciated skill and effort that we put into it, and also the contribution it makes to others. But this is undermined because of this fact of separation from the product, and also because of the lack of control we have over how we labor, or the alienation from the process of production. And in the recent book, Private Government, Elizabeth Anderson argued that most workers today labor on what under what amounts to a despotic dictatorship. Quote, consider some facts about how employers today control their workers. Walmart prohibits employees from exchanging casual remarks while on duty, calling that time theft. Apple inspects the personal belongings of their retail workers, who lose up to half an hour of unpaid time every day as they wait in line to be searched. Tyson prevents its poultry workers from using the bathroom, and some of them have been forced to urinate on themselves while their supervisors mock them. About half of U.S. employees have been subject to suspicionless drug testing, and millions are pressured by their employers to support particular political causes and candidates. And if the U.S. government imposed such regulations on us, we would rightly protest that our constitutional rights were being violated. But American workers have no such right against their bosses. Even speaking out against such conditions can get them fired, so most keep silent. So whatever limited freedom we have to choose which boss will exploit us completely evaporates once we set foot on the job. And building on Marx's analysis of the labor process and capital, Harry, can you hold up that book? This book, which I highly recommend, Labor and Monopoly Capital, Harry Braverman kind of looks at the way that the work process is structured under capitalism. And one of his central insights is the way the division of labor is used under capitalism to accomplish two key goals. First is to cheapen labor, right? Because if you can take a complex process and break it down into smaller and simpler tasks, then you can pay each worker less to do that work. And secondly, to centralize control, because the more that management has the control and full knowledge of the process, and the less that individual workers do, the more they can set the terms of production and thereby increase exploitation. And Braverman emphasized that there's nothing inherent to the division of labor or the introduction of machinery that necessitate either the reduction of skill or the centralization of control. In fact, advances in machinery hold out the potential to emancipate humanity from much unnecessary labor, which theoretically could mean more free time and more creative and challenging work for everyone. But under capitalism, such advances only mean more meaningless and more alienated labor for the majority of us, all in the interests of maximizing profits. As Marx put it in the manuscripts, quote, labor produces wonderful things for the rich, but for the worker it produces privation. It produces palaces, but for the worker, hovels. It produces beauty, but for the worker, deformity. It replaces labor by machines, but it throws one section of workers back into a barbarous type of labor, and it turns another section into a machine. It produces intelligence, but for the worker, stupidity. And I think the massive expansion of capitalist production since Marx's time only serves to underscore this point. Following the decline of manufacturing, we're often told that we're entering a new knowledge economy, and that in place of backbreaking drudgery, workers who avail themselves of the right skills and education can expect more challenging and rewarding work. The tech sector is usually held up as an example of this. But for all the rhetoric, it's worth noting that the tech sector still only makes up 4% of the workforce, compared to 12% still in manufacturing. And a portion of those, of course, are Amazon warehouse workers and delivery drivers and whatnot. And the fastest growing job categories are not software engineers, but low-wage retail and service work. It's also the case that tech itself is undergoing the same process of de-skilling and rationalization. And in fact, software engineering is one job predicted to be automated in the coming years. But even at present, when tech workers certainly have a bit more autonomy and are better paid, working conditions are often highly exploitative and alienating. I mean, if people saw the articles about how it's normal for Amazon employees to cry at their desks, right? And it's not simply our physical and mental movements which are subject to control at work. The sociologist Arlie Hochschild famously coined the term emotional labors in her research describing the way in which flight attendants are expected not just to provide meals and service, but actually engage in a form of deep acting as an intrinsic part of their job. And she was writing really at the beginnings, in the 1980s, of the beginning of the process of deregulation and speed ups that have made airline travel the hell that we all know today. And flight attendants, of course, are needed to be the emotional shock absorbers for a lot of this frustration. And it's interesting to think about how large a portion of our daily interactions are ones in which either ourselves or the other person or both are actually required to act and appear to have a certain emotion because of our job, and how that might color the way we interact with each other more generally. And we'll get back to that in David's section. So a few months back, Starbucks unveiled a new initiative to employees called Operation North Star, which was in response to customer complaints about flagging service. And Starbucks CEO Kevin Johnson described it this way. Quote, "I think a key differentiator for Starbucks is that emotional connection our partners have to what we stand for, and the fact that we are in the business of human connection." At the end of the day, there's one thing that every person on this planet has in common, and that is the human experience, and that is a beautiful thing. A Starbucks employee had a slightly different interpretation. They said, quote, "Really, it's Starbucks saying, hey, we're going to keep understaffing you and running you ragged, but on top of that, we want you to be better at customer service. Oh, and you're not getting paid more for it either." So it should come as no wonder that the majority of working people feel incredibly alienated at their work. A few years back, Gallup conducted a worldwide study which concluded that only 13% of workers feel engaged at their job. And among the nearly two-thirds of disengaged workers, 24% are quote, actively disengaged, indicating they are unhappy and unproductive at work and liable to spread negativity to coworkers. And this comes at a real economic cost, right? When I was researching this, I came across countless sort of HR articles about how can we improve worker morale. Probably many of you guys in this room, I know at my work we have like these employee wellness programs that are supposed to make us feel better, and like we get points, so if we get enough points, we get a deduction on our health insurance. And one of my we watched these like webinars. One of my favorite was about the benefits of vacation, which they acknowledged, you know, you might not actually be able to take a vacation, but maybe you could sit at your desk and close your eyes for a few minutes and like visualize that. And that. And my favorite was actually, I went to a sleep seminar where the presenter was clearly sleep deprived. But at any rate, you know, regardless of how much it's framed as sort of feeling empathy for employees and having more humane practices, the intended goal is always the same, which is more productive workers and certainly fewer discontented and troublesome ones. In a recent headline, even cheerily noted that having sex regularly can make employees more productive. Because capitalism is so romantic. And I think, you know, so much is written about the impact of mental illness on our ability to be productive workers, but by comparison, there's very little on work itself as the cause of these mental health problems. But to be honest, it's almost shocking how seemingly well-adjusted most workers are, considering the conditions many of us labor under. And in the aftermath of the tragic shooting in San Francisco at a UPS facility, a UPS worker described in Socialist Worker the kind of conditions which might cause a person to snap, including mandatory overtime, backbreaking labor, sickness from breathing in dirty air, and impossible to meet quotas. And they write, quote, "This toxic work environment hurts not only union workers, but is visible on the faces of the low-level supervisors and managers who fear for their own jobs if they can't meet strict targets devised by their bosses. That means they are constantly harassing workers and trying to force them to work faster than before. The work pace is so fast and brutal that some workers learn to suck it up and get upset at other workers who don't do the same. Others slow down, realizing the faster they work, the more management will abuse them to go even faster." And the fact that UPS can get away with subjecting workers to such conditions, I think underscores the old adage that the only thing worse than having a job is not having one. The pervasive fear that we could at any minute lose our livelihood due to market forces beyond our control has far-reaching consequences. As psychologist Laura Kerr observed, quote, living in a capitalistic and globalized economy seems to require hypervigilance and constantly scanning for potential job loss, devaluing retirement accounts, if not the decimation of entire market sectors and local economies. For the most financially precarious and ever-widening sector of the population, capitalism creates a state similar to the psychological domination that can occur when people are held in captivity. And I think, as this last example shows, the role of alienated labor in our society has huge reverberations far beyond the workplace. And that, I will turn over to David.
So before I start, please take 30 seconds, check in with yourself, check in with someone around you, and introduce yourself. We want people to be as unalienated as possible before I start all the depressing talk. And I also have to put up a poster.
Put the other ones up as I'm speaking, so.
Start to wrap it up in about 20 seconds. Comrades, if you could wrap up your conversations, that would be fantastic.
Woo!
Yeah, thank you. All right. So hopefully everyone's doing okay. I want to start talking about commodity fetishism, not because Marx was into the same thing like foot fetishism or, Leela said capitalism is so sexy. That's not what he meant when he was talking about commodity fetishism. He was actually talking about, and I have a poster in the back if you can't see, that capitalism hides the real relationship behind how objects get created. The social relationship is masked by the exchange value of that object. We don't see that all that's created under capitalism is actually our own doing. It seems to us like the system is controlled by an invisible hand, or an invisible fist, if you will, instead of real human beings doing real human activity that we could have control over. This is important because capitalism makes everything into a commodity and sells it on the market, and then it seems like it's moving around on its own, not in our control. Capitalists rely on also expanding these markets. They want to make more money on every aspect of living and try to do so in whatever ways possible. They have opened up the whole globe down to ourselves in search of ways to sell things to make a profit. It even corrupts the most personal and sacred relationships that humans have in between each other. The Communist Manifesto does a great job in describing this process when, and I'll quote here, "The bourgeoisie has left remaining no other nexus between man and man than naked self-interest, the callous cash payment. It has drowned the most heavenly ecstasies in the icy water of egotistical calculation. It has resolved personal worth into exchange value." Commodification under capitalism makes healthcare, for instance, about making money instead of saving human lives. In the US, both parties are committed to the continued privatization and commodification of healthcare. Single payer just recently got close to being passed in California, but the Democratic Party, who has a two-thirds majority in the Senate, completely killed it. And the Republicans are no better. They are literally buying healthcare stocks as they are trying to rip up the Affordable Care Act. As we know, healthcare should be a right, not and should not be commodified, but because of profit motives, we can't organize healthcare that way, at least in the United States. Housing, food, entertainment, everything that we have is dominated by commodification and the drive to make profit. They even want to open up public education to the drive for profit. There was a talk that talked about that earlier. They even try to commodify our struggle. The heroic comrades that fought at Standing Rock set an example for the world. They declared in front of everyone, "Water is life." So imagine my surprise when I was in San Francisco, I saw a billboard that said, "Life Water," and it had like some indigenous type art that was on it. And I don't think it's a coincidence. They take imagery from our struggle, brand it, and kind of send it back to us. You can probably think of your own example, but another example is Pepsi commercial where they roll the can. All right, you can go through the whole thing. All right. Liberals also commodify the struggle in a different way. They make activism just a donation every month, or it becomes about how you spend your money instead of a serious challenge to the political system. They limit our struggles to monetary relationships, which are incredibly passive. Even more terrifying is that capitalism transforms our bodies from being human into labor power, something that can be sold on the market. We literally take something that is inherent to ourselves and sell it. Workers are compelled to take part in this commodification of labor because the alternative for workers is to starve and go without. The only thing that workers have to sell is their labor power, and this has profound effects on our lives. Of course, it's not like this just naturally happened. The enclosing of the commons in England, the destructions of people's way of life, what Marx termed primitive accumulation, this took away people's ability to exist outside of the markets. And so what now seems natural as a market had to be created through an active process that the bourgeoisie took part in. Okay, so this is where it gets kind of depressing, because we talk about alienation towards ourself. The commodification of labor leads to a sense of alienation that dominates our images of self and destroys our sense of self-worth. When we don't have control over our own human labor except to sell it, we start to see our own body as a tool and not as a natural thing of beauty. We are alienated from our own process of fulfillment as human beings as we have to sell our labor power party. Sometimes we sell that too. Marx's idea was that what makes us different as a species is that we're able to do work like bees and beavers, but in addition, we're able to reflect, change, invent, in other words, to think about what we're doing. This separates us from all the other life forms on this planet. Marx labeled this our species being. I think I have one. All right, right here, good. Just in case you're following along.
Oh, that didn't go very well. Whatever.
All right. Can everyone see it? No. Good. Okay, and what he meant is that this defines you know, who we are and what we do. Engels even had a pamphlet that was never completed, but it was talking about the role of labor in the transition from ape to man, in which he posits that the labor process literally changed our evolutionary process and set us on a different path. And this is what makes us different. Thank you. What then constitutes... in the economic and philosophic manuscripts that Leela was talking about earlier, there's a great quote that talks about this alienation from self. Quote, "When then constitutes the alienation of labor? What then constitutes the alienation of labor? First, the fact that labor is external to the worker, i.e., it does not belong to his intrinsic nature, that in his work, therefore, he does not affirm himself, but denies himself, does not feel content, but unhappy, does not develop freely his physical and mental energy, but mortifies his body and ruins his mind. The worker, therefore, only feels himself outside of his work, and in his work feels outside of himself. He feels at home when he is not working, and when he is working, he does not feel at home." Unquote. This alienation of what makes us human so that we don't feel at home at work leads to depression, anger, abuse of drugs, negative body image. You could list all of the different possible things that come out of that, but it's going to be an impossibly long list. it should make us pause and think, as Leela mentioned, that 1 in 6 adults, in according to NBC, in the U.S. are on antidepressants. There's a reason that self-help books are a huge industry and the opioid crisis is happening. It's a product of this alienation. We are told that there's something wrong with each individual who's experiencing these things and that we have to solve it on our own. This was certainly not Marx's view. And if you think about it for a second, why would so many people feel alienated from their own self if it was just an individual thing? It's not natural for people to be so depressed and addicted, but it's a product of our system. I think I have time. Can you pass me that, Wally?
Wallace Shawn.
Great. So there was a reading with Wallace Shawn at the conference, and I thought it was amazing. And he has a quote in this book, Night Thoughts, that I thought fit perfectly with what it means to be human. He says, there's no reason to doubt that every healthy human infant is born with the potential to play music beautifully, to read with sensitivity, to do scientific research, to put on plays, to draw and paint, and certainly to think. To understand, to reason, to analyze arguments, and naturally also to develop, to grow. But almost all of those who are born unlucky have been brutally prevented from developing more than a fraction of their own abilities. And this perhaps is the most shocking fact about our human world. So we're not only alienated from ourselves, we're also alienated from each other. Commodity fetishism and selling of labor power lead us to being alienated from each other. Anyone who has been on a job interview, had a shitty boss, I assume that's all of you, has felt alienated from those with power over them. Bosses and managers in particular are the people who make workers do work in the interests of capitalism. It's not just terrible bosses, it's also the good bosses that are a part of the problem. Either way, good or bad, they alienate us from our ability to make decisions for ourselves, and their job is to literally make us into a part of the machine. They have different interests than workers, and I don't think anyone in here would doubt that there's a conflict between bosses and workers, obviously. But then we also are in competition against each other. We are constantly being organized to compete on the job market. As Dan Swain says in Alienation, Anna, do you have that book? That book right there, Alienation and Introduction to Marxist Theory, people then relate to each other, quote, people then relate to each other not directly but through commodities. This means that the relationship between human beings begins to look like the relationship between objects, unquote. Because we confront each other competing to sell our labor power, we confront each other as commodities fighting over the same resources and the same jobs. This has disturbing effects on solidarity. While the ruling class consciously spreads the politics of division, it is the conditions of competition that reinforce racism, sexism, and the like. This is not an excuse for such ideas. It is merely an explanation of why these ideas can take root in the working class. Marx's idea is that we need revolution not just because we need to get rid of the ideas that people have accumulated through the process of capitalism. If the problem is that we're competing with each other on the labor market, then it would seem natural that unions could be a possible way to change its relationship. Unions limit the competition between workers as they control the labor market in a more fair way. An injury to one is an injury to all is a better way to organize the labor market than the way that the bosses constantly sow division. However, especially in this country, we've seen the slow destruction of the union movement over the last 40 years. Unions are less and less able to play the role of moderating the labor market. In the Bay Area, there's we have a transit system called BART, and they went on strike. They were demonized as privileged workers because they had a union and had higher wages than unorganized people, and that the bosses constantly pitted the ununionized workers against the unionized workers, and really they turned the public opinion against the strike because of that. And so even with a union, you're still going to get the competition and between workers and each other. Okay, how do we solve alienation? There's lots of ideas about how to solve alienation. We obviously all need to take care of ourselves. This is not an argument against self-care, but capitalism has commodified all sorts of self-help strategies. There is a trend of mindfulness training for corporations. There's one corporation called Search Inside Yourself Institute. Great name, guys. And they do mindfulness training for other companies. And they advertise themselves as leading to 36% reduction in stress levels, a 62.0, I don't know why they put .0, it's weird, minute increase in production each week, 7% lower healthcare costs, and $3,000 saved per year based on gains in productivity. So they sell mindfulness in terms of we can increase your productivity. These are management tools in the same way that Taylorism is. It's not anything that we should accept. We should be very critical, in fact, because I think it corrupts real self-care, and I think if we were really mindful at work, we would probably slow down. We would probably be more careful. We would probably take time to take naps and take care of ourselves. So we should be quite critical of this. Someone at the conference in one of the first meetings I went to said something along the lines, I feel like self-help has been turned into something that you can buy. And I think that that's a pretty accurate description of a lot of the self-help things that are out there. As Leela mentioned, tech companies are seen as a great place to work. I've been to the Google building. They have foosball tables and pool tables and beer on Thursday and a kitchen and blah, blah, like all types of stuff. But a recent article in The Economist said only 19% of tech employees say they were happy with their jobs. And 17% said they felt valued at their work. So it's clearly not, even people in those environments still feel alienated. Some might say the gig economy, self-employed or freelance workers, but because they have to compete on a market that's dominated by these large corporations, they also have to take part in exploitation. Good. So it gets reimposed through the market forces. And obviously, I think everyone should have a hobby and do-it-yourself stuff. I rock climb, for instance. But we don't have time to explore any of our hobbies, right? We don't have time to go through and it's less alienating because you get when you do have time, you have some control over what you do and why you do it. But increasingly, that stuff is, we just don't have time to fully explore any of that. So all of the various individual solutions rely on just being nicer people, and it's important to be nice. We shouldn't be mean, but it's just this idea that just be nicer despite the fact that we don't have control over production, that we don't have control over our lives. All right, some other things that might increase or make us less alienated, at least in this country, social reforms, labor unions, healthcare, robust safety net, they will mitigate some of the effects of alienation, but they won't solve it in a fundamental way. Okay, this is my conclusion. The commodification of labor leads us to Marx's main ideas about being alienated. Oops, here we go, last one. In case you missed the summary, we are alienated from our products, we are alienated from the process of work, we are alienated from ourselves, and we are alienated from each other. There are many ways that we are sold solutions to these problems, but most are based on individualism and consumptionism. These don't make us less alienated, and in some cases make us more alienated. What's revolutionary about Marx's idea about alienation is that despite all this, he sees that there's a collective interest that workers have in overthrowing the system. Capitalism organizes our work in a way that we can provide for everyone's needs if we actually had control over the system. Alienation is one of the key compelling Marxist ideas that leads to the concept of revolution. To solve our relationship to the work process, we have to overthrow the hierarchy of work. We need a social revolution that puts control of work back in the hands of those who do the work. That is really the only way that we can overcome this profound alienation. Leela at the beginning proposed that becoming involved in revolutionary activity may make us feel less alienated. I think that's true. I find it true in my own personal experience, where I felt totally angry as a growing up kid and didn't know where to direct that anger. There are important positive effects that you can gain from being involved in revolutionary politics. We get a sense of purpose, belonging, who the real enemies are, i.e. the capitalists. But it won't solve the problem. Think of this conference. It's an incredible learning experience. It's motivating, it's inspiring, it's sustaining us for the fights to come. At the same time, with so many people, it's hard to get a chance to speak. It can feel like an overwhelming experience to learn so much, and it can sometimes even be hard to interact amongst comrades. Not to mention the fact that you have to go back to work after this. In other words, finding revolutionary politics can't undo the effect of alienation on our society. Only an actual revolution can do that.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.